Okay, folks, let's go ahead and start the meeting. Just to orient people, it is Saturday, it's July 12th, and this is the monthly Zoom meeting for the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. My name is Janice Bellucci, and I am, in fact, Executive Director of the organization, as well as founder of the organization. Okay, so I was in the middle of introductions. Again, this is the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws, our monthly Zoom meeting. It is July 12th, Saturday. And I welcome you all here. I also thank you for participating. This is 1 week different than our normal time when we would speak. And the reason is that I'm on a family vacation next Saturday. In fact, I'll be in an airplane next Saturday at this time. And so that's why the date was changed. So anyway, again, thank you, thank you, thank you. We have a lot of ground to cover today, as usual. Before I go there, let me introduce some of our board members. Roger Honeycutt is an Axol board member. Ta-da! He is our IT expert, and he's the one who posts articles on the website as well as comments. We do have a backup to Roger and another gentleman who doesn't participate and is not a board member. We have Jeff Stein, who is an Axol board member. Jeff is a criminal defense attorney. Jeff is a very valuable member of our team. He's been on the board a couple of years now, I
Couple
think.
of years.
How time flies when you're having fun. In addition to that, we have Rick Chu. Rick is a member of the foundation board of directors, and I do expect one more Axol board member to arrive. And when she arrives, I will introduce her. So let's go ahead and get started with the meeting. Marty, if you'll be so kind as to give some folks some information about the emotional support group meetings and other ways that they can, in fact, engage.
My pleasure, Janice. All right, so we all know the traumatic effects of the registry on ourselves and our loved ones. Boldness, loss of family and friends, difficulty securing work and housing. Life can be difficult for everyone affected. It's overall. That's why Axol runs emotional support group meetings every week. Our next meetings will be on Thursday and 1 week from today. Wait a minute. No, today is the second Saturday, isn't it? How do you like that? It's today. Yes. And it's not just for registrants. It's for our loved ones and supporters. You know, whoever you want to have in there with us, whoever might need a little bit of emotional support, all are welcome. I'll throw a little caveat on that in just a moment. Every Thursday evening, Axol board member Sherry Moreno runs the group beginning at 6:30 Pacific, 9:30 Eastern. The second and fourth Saturday of each month, today, licensed therapist and Axol board member Alex Kittinger leads the Saturday Zoom meetings. The time, 3 o'clock Pacific, 6 o'clock Eastern. At every meeting, we have a friendly community supporting each other. There's no cost, and we vet every participant. So here's the caveat. We don't have trolls. We don't have bullies, no law enforcement, no Proud Boys, or anyone who would try to cause us grief. They are vetted and removed before they ever get a chance to get in. So how can you get access to participate in this wonderful supportive group? Please see the information that I will post in the chat moments after I finish the announcement. If you'd like to join today's group, very important, if you want to join today's group, you can email me before the end of this meeting at thanksfortheinfamy@gmail.com. Look at the title above me. Thanksfortheinfamy@gmail.com. Please be sure to include your name and phone number. You will receive a phone call from a block number within 1/2 hour after this meeting ends. Please pick up that call. And I promise, after participating in the Axol emotional support groups, you will feel a lot better about yourself. And I'd just like to add, I'd rather be a registrant at an Axol emotional support group meeting with mutually caring and understanding friends than the human beings who are currently being held in Alligator Alcatraz, or as I like to call it, Alligator Auschwitz. Please be safe, everyone. Back to you, Janice.
I guess it would help if I put the audio on.
Audio it switch. Does.
Okay, thank you. So, folks, you know, Axol offers many types of support for people on the registry and for family members of registrants. Marty has just described the ones that are talked about people's emotions, about their feelings. Folks, that's really, really important. I mean, sometimes I'm not on the registry myself. However, I listen to people on the registry every day, and I know that there are so many challenges, that you experience every single day. So what we're trying to do is give you information in the monthly Zoom meetings like this, and then we have other groups that can address people's feelings. And I don't know, we should have called them support groups a heck of a long time ago. And so can I just call it a support group? Consciousness raising, whatever term you want to use. But the fact is, it's a place that's safe. safe, like Marty just described. There won't be any trolls there. Law enforcement is not welcome there and will be removed if they show up without an invitation. So thank you, Marty, for that information. Folks, I think that the best thing that we do as at the Alliance is we provide you all with hope and support. Okay. So these Zoom meetings are one form of support. The emotional support group meetings are another form of support. And then we do other things as well. But all of this is to actually, they're delivery methods to bring you one message, and that message is hope. Please, please, please know that to be hopeful that things are going to improve, things have improved, things are improving, and yet we do have some setbacks along the way. So sometimes I think about being on the registry, believe it or not, as a, yeah, I'm gonna think of it, a video game and stuff. And sometimes I think of it as just a trip down, any road in your car, right? You don't always know where you're going. You don't always know what the conditions are going to be, but we all need to be resilient. We need to be flexible so that we can, in fact, successfully navigate these obstacles. And I'm serious about that. So the information that Jeff and I and other lawyers give you is information that we hope will, in fact, allow you to successfully navigate the obstacles that you face every day. So please understand again, our overall message is hope. So we have, as an organization, had to deal with an issue that we wish you wouldn't have had to deal with. And so there's a message that's been sent out to folks. It's posted on the website. But indeed, the board of directors of Axol made a really difficult decision when it met this week, and that decision was to cancel this year's conference. So it was not this. It was a decision that, we talked about a lot. We weighed many factors before making that decision, and it only and the bottom line is it only made sense to go ahead and cancel this year's conference. So we're going to have a conference next year. We know that with 100% certainty. But this year, a number of things are going on, and this time I'm going to compare it to an earthquake. So there's an earthquake going on. That earthquake affected another organization more directly than others, than us rather. And so that organization is known as NARSOL. So NARSOL had a conference scheduled, an in-person conference scheduled in June, and there was an extremist group that caused a lot of trouble. And the trouble that they caused was with the hotel, and the hotel, for whatever reason, don't know what their rationale is, what they were thinking, but the hotel basically canceled the contract that NARSOL had to hold its conference there. They did this less than 2 weeks before the conference. Less than 2 weeks, right? So NARSOL is scrambling to try to figure out if, in fact, they can reschedule their conference this year. Again, it's an in-person conference. Can they reschedule it for this year? If so, when, and if so, where? So they're not giving us any inside information about when and where, except that the rumor is that they're going to do it in October. Our conference was going to be the last weekend in September, okay? And so we did not think that it would, well, we wanted to be gracious, actually. Gracious to NARSOL and let them reschedule their conference without having to think about the date of our conference. And in fact, they also, I'm understanding, are considering late September. So we want to give them the opportunity to have to reschedule their in-person conference. And another thing that happened, folks, is that we had two of our speakers, two of our keynote speakers, who changed their mind after NARSOL canceled their conference and said they were no longer willing to even participate in a virtual conference, such as Axol was going to hold this year. So, looking at that, looking at all these factors that exist today, this important decision had to be made. If you all want to talk about it, we can talk about it. I'm, sorry to be the bearer of bad news. We believe that the conferences play an important role. It's certainly a great way to share information. By the way, I personally prefer an in-person conference, so that we can meet each other, so we can network in the hallways and other places, and that. So, but again, this year we thought it was necessary, basically, let things calm down. And so, the group that we're talking about, I don't want to hide that information. The group we're talking about is the Proud Boys. So, I'm sure we've all heard about the Proud Boys and what they do and what they don't do and what they're capable of doing. But it's just, to me, an opportunity, or to let things quiet down before we we do what we need to do. And by the way, Roger had a really good idea and we're going to implement it, which is okay, instead of having a conference, a 2-day conference, we're going to, in not this meeting, but in future meetings, we're going to invite guest speakers to come to the monthly Zoom meetings and we're going to have like a mini conference, but it'll be over several months instead of having, one conference altogether. So this is we're working with options, we're working with possibilities here. We want to convey information to you, and we do every month, of course, in these Zoom meetings and the emotional support group meetings as well. But this is just something that seemed a bridge too far at this point in time. So I'm just going to open open up the mic here, I guess. If you have a question or a comment, please raise your hand either virtually. That's easier to do if you go to the bottom of the toolbar because I'll see you. It's more likely that I'll see you. But again, if you have a comment or a question, actually, Roger, if you don't mind, maybe you could weigh in right now.
Yeah, it is a very valid concern, and we want to be sensitive to the needs of NARSOL, especially since we're trying to work together with all these groups, right? We want a national effort, unified. We don't want to, in the past, unfortunately, some of our organizations haven't been able to work together as much as we want. And as you've been seeing in the Washington, D.C. event, hopefully you guys saw that, it was really cool to see everybody working together, unified. And so we need to be open to the needs of other groups. So I think this is very necessary. It'll also encourage our speakers, and having people speak at this meeting will definitely be a nice thing for you guys. You get to have like little mini conferences. So I'm pretty excited about what we're doing for this year. And then next year, we'll see what happens.
All right. Thank you, Roger. And GSH has his hand up, his or her hand up.
Thank you. Yes, I have a friend who travels with impunity and he doesn't know his risk. What does one say to a friend who you want to keep rather than one that's in prison? What do I say to that friend to encourage him to come to these meetings and learn more about the issue?
You can tell him what a friendly group we are. If I knew who he was, I could buy him a cup of coffee. We said travel with impunity. Are you talking about traveling overseas?
No, he goes within the Midwest. He's domiciled in Michigan.
Well, I mean, for one thing, and folks, I'm going to make this answer fairly quick because I was hoping that we were talking about a different topic, which is a conference. And I will be talking more about domestic and overseas travel. But I think that, your friend should understand the risk that he's taking. I mean, would somebody jump in a car and put a blindfold on? I think not. I mean, if they were the driver, that doesn't make sense to me. I would think that a person would want to know what the risks are, and then you can make a decision about how much risk you're willing to take. And folks, we take risk every day, right? When we jump in, when we drive a car, we are taking a risk. So, we're obviously, most of us are willing to take some risk in that regard. The question is, how much of a risk do you want to take?
Thanks, Janice.
You're certainly welcome. Rick, you have your hand up.
I just want to thank the AXOL board for being so proactive in protecting this organization.
Thank you, Rick.
And I'm strengthened by the idea that that AXOL will definitely have a conference next year. And
Yes.
I think it's so prudent to go ahead and let all this stuff that's going on in the nation and in the political realm to just quiet down a little bit until so that we can conduct ourselves in a dignified and safe manner. Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome. Herman, you have your hand up.
Hey, I just wanted to say that I understand the rationale and everything, but I feel like the only winners here are the Proud Boys. They got a big win and we're all standing down. And as a registrant myself, I don't feel any more at risk at a conference. In fact, I think I'm safer at a conference than I am at my own house. And I just wish that going forward, we would not stand down, that we would do the right thing and have our voices be heard. We're in the public square doing what we're lawfully entitled to do, participating in the American system, public discourse. We're not doing anything wrong. And for them to sling all this information, misinformation about a pedophile group, and then we go silent and cancel everything, they got a massive win. And I hope that we would think about that and going forward, have a different strategy. Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. And Herman, I want you to know we did think about those things. We did. And that was a serious factor that was considered. And, you know, one of the things, and hopefully next year's conference will be back at the law school. The great thing about the law school is they have their own security force. So Proud Boys are not going to get in the building, right? I'm not the least bit worried about that. It's just at this point in time, and as I said, I feel like we're, you know, in the middle of an earthquake right now, and you want to get to safety. And once you're once you're safe, then you can, in fact, plan ahead. So that's where we are today. Martin, and I appreciate your comment, Herman, I do. Martin, you have your hand up?
Yes. Hi. Thank you, Janice. And thank you, Herman, for bringing that up, because I had mixed emotions about that as well, and you're a lot braver to bring it up. I don't know how I feel about it, but I feel, I've been feeling this for several months, a concern about the Proud Boys. And I don't know if we're being political here or not, but this sort of fascist echo from the past. And the last time Nazis did this, they started with sex offenders or the outsiders. And so I just wanted to throw that out just to kind of plant a seed. I've missed several of the Axol meetings, but I just hope there is some rumination about if and when, you know, right now, everybody that's being gathered up and disappeared, they have their, you know, focus. Who knows how large this is going? And again, I think I'm maybe worrying too much, but I just would like, I'm wondering if it's a thought.
Well, Martin, it is a thought. It's a sad and serious thought. And I'm somebody who is not Jewish. Marty's Jewish, so maybe he can speak to this with more authority. But I've been interested in studying about the Holocaust since I was a teenager, and I continue to study it and read about it. And I agree with you. And by the way, I was quoted correctly in the Los Angeles Times probably about 5 years ago as saying that what's going on with registrants today is similar to what happened to the Jews in Nazi Germany. I've never gotten so much hate mail and hate phone calls in my life. So the folks, the Jewish community, thought that was a bad comparison, and they let me know it. Okay, I can accept criticism. It's okay, but they didn't change my mind. I still believe that.
And I think what happened in the Holocaust is something for all of us to learn from. However, because it was so tragic and ugly, we tend to forget about all the peripheral people that were sucked up with it. And I guess I just wanted to voice that.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you, Martin. Okay, so just moving on. again, the conference for this year has been canceled, and we are going to plan. We have very small beginning plans to have a conference next year. One reason we're going to have a virtual conference this year is that the people who attended last year's virtual conference thought it was so valuable, and that we were able to, in fact, have more people from different states participate. That's why we're going to have a virtual conference this year. We are definitely considering once again having an in-person conference, and I think, you know, what might be the determining factor is whether or not we can in fact have it at the law school, because as I said, it's a very secure building. They in fact have their own security force, and I've always felt comfortable and safe in that building. Mark in transit, your hand is up.
Oh, hi. And it was camp's imprisonment was started 8 years before the murders were started, by the way. I know it's very important to have the open meetings the way we do. And I've always wondered if maybe there is a time to kind of restrict access just on the publication of, you know, when the meetings are, and then maybe, you know, just the minimum of checking in and saying, you know that it's not legal to do this or do that, and you're intending for yourself. And I know that's not a perfect solution, but just a thought. Thank you, Pat.
Okay, thank you, Mark. Those are definitely good points. Thank you. And my hat's off to the Zoom company, Zoom.com anyway, whoever owns that, because they're actually doing a really good job of protecting meetings like this. And so we've only had one disruption. It was not actually during a monthly meeting. It was during a webinar. And at that point in time, we weren't as knowledgeable, shall we say, of security options when Zoom meetings. We're much more knowledgeable now. And in fact, I myself and now Roger, because he's co-host, we have the ultimate decision here, folks. And if anybody gets rowdy, if anybody says anything appropriate or wants to show anything inappropriate, you will be removed from the room and you will not be able to come back in. So I appreciate that concern. I so far, you know, knock on wood or something else here, that in fact, we have not been disrupted in our monthly meetings. And I don't know. I mean, from time to time, Roger and I talk about that. He's really much more technically oriented than I am. Roger, is there anything you want to add here?
It really comes down to a trade-off between how difficult do we make it for someone to attend versus security. And I think what we have now is a good balance, because if we start adding passwords to it, things like that, how do you filter? How do you vet people? You know, it's a very important question. How do we know if someone says, hey, I want to come to your meeting? If we require that, how do we know? Now, if you look, for example, at the emotional support meetings, they do a really thorough job talking to the person personally to see, you know, are you a cop? Are you a registrant supporter? For us to do that for, you know, 100 people at meetings, I think would become cumbersome, and we would probably have only a fraction of the people showing up. So yes, security is important. And I'm sitting here right now. I have a monitor. I'm looking at people. I can see who logged in last. By the way, we've disabled renaming in case you're trying to rename. That's a security issue. In case Zoom Palmer wants to impersonate one of you and do something profane, I can instantly suspend and report someone. So I think right now we have a good balance of what we can do. If we get any more restrictive, people may not show up.
Thank you, Roger. Paul Roberts, you have your hand up?
Yes, I was hoping, this is my first time with a meeting, and I was hoping to get the information for the emotional support groups and stuff like that. Maybe I can talk to somebody, give them my email address or something like that so that they could send me the information.
Paul, the information, can you access the chat? Part of this, the chat part of this Zoom meeting, because if you can, it's there. So at, but Marty said he's going to put it up again as well. But at 10:07 this morning, Marty put all the information there for you. And for others as well. So that's how we started this meeting out. We started out with a discussion about the emotional support group meetings and other similar organizations. Again, the organizations and events that support people on the registry and their loved ones.
How do I save that stuff off the chat? I'm kind of new at this.
I think that's a Roger question. So
you can highlight it. You highlight the text you want, copy it with Control C, and then paste it somewhere else. But you can just click on the link that's in there. But yeah, or you can take your mouse and drag it along the information you want and then do a Control C and then paste it into like a Word file with Control V. So that's how you would do that.
Or Paul, I'll just say I'm technically not advanced. And so what I would do is take a photograph of that and type it, use it later. Just type it in later. But many different possibilities here. Okay. All right. Thank you, Roger. Okay. So Roger has helped me out of so many jams over the years. I really appreciate you, Roger. Thank you for one more time here. Okay. So another thing that happened during the past month is some people had trouble accessing the Axol website. So I don't know if any of you were affected by this. If you are, if you want to speak to that today, let us know. It turned out there are some people who are on supervised release, which is like the federal version of probation, and they have monitoring software on their phones and on their computers. And so they were being blocked access to the Axol website, and the reason given was it was pornography. Now, maybe because the word sex is in there, sad to say, but maybe that's the reason why, or maybe not. I was actually able to figure out what needed to happen. And so basically all a person needs to do is make a phone call. And of course, it's never easy to get to a human being, but it is possible to get to a human being and let them know that Axol, because once they check, I did this for two different people. Once the person on the other end of the line in customer service checked, they go, oh, well, it's not pornography. Okay, sure. And they were able to flip some switch somewhere. And then the person was able to get access to our website in an hour. an hour's time pretty fast. And Roger, I see your hand is up, sir.
Yes, and related to that, if you or anyone else is not receiving our emails, occasionally our email system they have a policy in order to be federally compliant. And if nobody has responded to our mails or they're getting bounced too much, or there's a number of different factors that you can actually be put on a blocked list. And so I'm going to put my email in the chat. If you or someone else is not receiving our emails, contact me and I'll tell you the procedure that you follow that tells our email company, hey, put me back, unblock me so I can get the emails. So please let me know. And if you hear of anyone who's been not receiving it, let me know, because we have no way of knowing who has been blocked. And that is also, unfortunately, a legal requirement. I have no way of knowing if you're not receiving our emails. Thanks.
And thank you, Roger. Okay. So as if we haven't already discussed enough challenges, there's one more that needs to be discussed this morning. Only one more, I promise. And that has to do with the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision. So the case is called Trump versus CASA, C-A-S-A, and it has to do with injunctive relief. And folks, maybe that sounds like a scary or confusing term, injunctive relief. But the fact is, I'm sure you've heard of TROs, temporary restraining orders. Maybe you've heard of preliminary injunctions or even permanent injunctions. So that's what this Supreme Court case is discussing. And it basically talks about what they think are universal injunctions or universal relief. And they basically, the U.S. Supreme Court has said, those are not appropriate. So we're not talking about the final decision in the case, but we're talking about stopping something from happening. That's through like a temporary restraining order, preliminary or permanent injunction, or we're talking about making something happen, I guess like a writ of mandamus. So it's a discouraging decision for those of us who file lawsuits on behalf of registrants, because it's basically saying that if you file a lawsuit as an individual, whatever the injunctive relief that's provided is only going to be given to you and not to everybody else who is similarly situated. And I'm going to ask Jeff to weigh in on this a minute. And I know Ellie Stein, another Axel board member and criminal defense attorney, I believe, has joined us now. So the two of you can prepare what you want to say about this U.S. Supreme Court decision and how it might affect people on the registry and our litigation. So I know we have two cases pending right now that could be directly affected by this U.S. Supreme Court decision. One of them is the Missouri Halloween case. We had, in that case, the district court judge issued a permanent statewide injunction. That is something that's extremely important. As an attorney, I feel like I won an Academy Award, quite frankly, by getting that injunction. And now the Attorney General of Missouri and that case is on appeal to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. And right now, the Attorney General of Missouri is already asking the Eighth Circuit to lift the permanent injunction in that case. And the other case that's pending that involves people on the registry and more people than the Missouri case, quite frankly, it has to do with the case that's basically challenging the SORNA regulations. So the SORNA regulations were issued about 2.5 years ago. They've been challenged. The litigation has been going on for quite some time. We, Axel, are a plaintiff in the lawsuit, and the Pacific Legal Foundation is actually the litigator. So I'm very concerned about this. I'm really concerned that in order to get injunctive relief in the future, that we are going to have to file a lot of class action lawsuits. So why don't I call on Jeff, if you're ready, Jeff, to weigh in on this?
Good morning, everybody. So this is sort of down in the weeds, and it's a strategy that the Trump administration has employed primarily as a means to evade judicial scrutiny. So as most people know, you know, we have this three-part system of government where the legislature passes laws, the executive branch enforces them, and the judicial interprets. So as part of their judicial interpretation role, judges around the country have historically had the authority to issue restraining orders, either temporary, meaning preliminary, or permanent, that are affecting not only the people that bring the lawsuits, called the plaintiffs, but everybody who's similarly situated. So the cases that Janice mentioned, we had those successes for those broad classes of people that were protected. And the effect of the CASA decision is to say to trial judges, the thing that you normally historically have relied upon to issue orders that are either statewide or national in enforcement is overused and inappropriate. It's sort of exercising the court's administrative role, and that they can't be done that way. One of the justices, Justice Coney Barrett, suggested, as I think is evident to people that do this work, that an alternative would be to do a class action. So class actions have their own set of extensive rules about what must be done. Yesterday, there was a class action that was very young that got a national scope order that looked identical to the ones that were prohibited by the CASA case, but, you know, it's still working its way through the legal system. And it's encouraging people that are doing the work to try and identify alternative tools, class action being the most evident one. And if it were workable, if it is workable, it becomes an identical remedy to the one that the CASA case slapped down. And it's just a matter of it has to now work through the system and then survive through the legal process with the six conservatives on the Supreme Court to determine whether it's going to be an adequate alternative.
Thank you, Jeff. Ellie, would you like to add to that?
Sure. Just to give some context to Trump versus CASA, it started out with the president wanting and ordering that children who were born to undocumented individuals would not be citizens, which is in violation of, I believe, the 14th Amendment. And so one of Trump's orders was to say that children born without, you know, two undocumented parents would not be citizens, and therefore they would have no citizenship at all. They wouldn't belong to any country. And so there were judges in many states who took on this issue and issued the injunctions to stop preventing that from happening. And Trump versus CASA said, no, you can't have an injunction that affects the entire country, because that's what, in essence, they were trying to do. And so recently, I think a couple of days ago in New Hampshire, the ACLU filed a class action lawsuit for the same issue to prevent the order that children born to undocumented individuals would not be citizens of the United States. And I believe the judge said, I will make this order effective in 7 days in order to allow for any appeals that might occur. And so what Trump versus CASA did was trying to prevent one method of relief, but there's another method of relief, and that's the class action lawsuit. That, as Jeff said, it takes more work. And yesterday in Los Angeles, a district court judge held that the raids by immigration on undocumented people were unconstitutional because they're violating the individual's rights. They're not giving the individual access to lawyers. And as I read it, she only allowed that order to be in the seven counties that are in the Central District of California. I haven't been able to find out if this was a class action or some type of injunctive relief. I believe it was injunctive relief, but it's limited to only the counties in the Central District of California. So I'm going to wait and see if there's more information in regard to that order. And obviously, my guess is there's going to be an appeal by the government. But, you know, if undocumented individuals are in the same boat as, you know, people who are despised. And so hopefully we can get some information as to how the government is going to go forward. Janice already heard from her case in Missouri that the attorney general says, wait a minute, you can't use injunctive relief. And we're still waiting to hear on the SORNA case that's pending in the Central District of California. But there are still tools, and we're just trying to figure out how best to use them in order to go forward with the issues that we have on behalf of registrants.
Thank you, Ellie. Thank you for the valuable additional comments you made. Some folks, I understand that's some things that you weren't expecting us to talk about today, especially the Supreme Court decision, but we really need to know what's going on. You really need to know the big picture here so that we can all be effective at making changes. And again, helping people who are on the registry successfully navigate around and through the obstacles that are in front of them. So I wish the world looked different right now, but it doesn't. And so again, we need to understand what's going on and then how we can in fact work around it. And so, talking about class action lawsuits, never done one before, but I'm willing to learn and willing to do that because there are some times when class action lawsuits, may in the future be the only way to get the effective relief that you want. Because otherwise, think about this, a government at any level could just do something that violates the Constitution. And then, it's possible when you have a civil lawsuit, it can take years till you get to the end of the civil lawsuit. So, if there's no injunctive relief available, then they can do this unconstitutional thing or action for years before, in fact, they're told, no, actually, you can't do that. So that's why injunctive relief is so important. Okay, so let's move on. Let's talk about travel. It is the summertime. Many people are traveling, as I mentioned at the beginning of this meeting. In fact, the reason we don't have the meeting next Saturday on the 19th of July is because I will be on a family vacation and traveling. And I'll be on a plane exactly at this time next week. So if you're on the registry and you decide to travel, you just need to know that there are obstacles, okay? And we can't, as attorneys, Jeff, Ellie, and I cannot even define for you specifically what obstacles are out there because it really depends upon where you plan to visit, how long you plan to visit, and oh, by the way, how you get there as well. So that's why if you call one of us up and go, well, I want to go visit this state and I want to know, do I have to register when I get there? And the other thing that's unclear about this, and we're talking about travel within the United States, some states say if you have to register in the state where you were convicted, you have to register when you come visit at our state if you stay X number of days or longer. Some people say, no, that's not necessary. And there's everything in between. So I can't tell you off the top of my head the most the place you can visit without concern is Washington, D.C., believe it or not. So if you want to go to Washington, D.C. and visit, I'm not talking about moving there. The fact is in Washington, D.C., you don't have to register. You can stay there as long as you want as a visitor, and you don't have to register there. Okay, well, let's talk about the other end of the spectrum. And the other end of the spectrum, Florida and Nevada, both are in that category, which is if you're there for 48 hours or longer, you're going to have to register. And I do mean the whole state of Florida, and I do mean the whole state of Nevada. So the question is, why do you want to register in another state? And think about it. If you've got a three-day vacation in Nevada, if you're going to have to spend one of those days registering, well, now you're down to a two-day visit to Nevada. Okay. So we're telling you about these things for that purpose. And by the way, if you don't register in the state when you go visit and you're legally required to do that, you could be charged with and convicted of failing to register, just like in your home state. And guess what? That means court time, court costs, and could mean time in custody, in jail or in prison. So we're trying to help you avoid those things from happening. So I'm not going to go through every state today because it's just too complex. There's just too many factors to consider. But I do recommend that if there's a place that you go to, another state that you go to on a regular basis, talk to a legal professional in that state and find out what the rules are that apply directly to you. It only makes sense, folks, because it's, Ellie and Jeff and all the attorneys and I, we're not the ones who are going to end up getting charged with a criminal offense or possibly going into custody if you don't pay attention to these rules. It's going to be you. And we're not here to discourage your travel. I wish that you didn't have to think about this at all, but please do think about it. And then you can decide what amount of risk you want to take. So let's talk about overseas travel. I think in some respects, overseas travel is easier than domestic travel because there are fewer rules. I guess that's the reason why. So overseas travel is, in fact, under the auspices of the International Megan's Law. And International Megan's Law requires anybody who's required to register to give a 21-day notice prior to leaving the United States to go travel overseas. And this is just a visit, folks. This is not moving. moving overseas. This is just visiting. So if you have a burning desire to see the Eiffel Tower and the Roman Colosseum, which you can do, you have to give 21-day notice. This at least 21 days notice. I always think 30 days is safer because who knows what they're going to do with your paperwork. But anyway, so 21, the notice of 21 days. If you're considered a, quote, covered sex offender, and a covered sex offender is, in fact, somebody who's required to register plus, I'll think of it in a second here. And by the way, I want to qualify that too. It has to be, your victim has to be under the age of 18. A minor, okay? So if your victim is a minor and you're required to register, then in fact, you have to get a unique identifier added to your passport. And I hate to say that, I'm just quoting what the law says. I do not agree with that requirement whatsoever. And so I know earlier in this discussion, we talked a little bit about Nazi Germany. Folks, you know, the only two countries in the history of the world who've ever done this to their citizens are Nazi Germany and also to Russia. And in both cases, they were Jews. So if you were a Jewish citizen, they would put a designation on your passport saying you were Jewish. And I've seen a picture of what the Nazis did. I have never seen a picture of what the USSR did. But when it came to the Nazis, they put a very, very large red J, and everybody knew that you were a Jew. And at one point in time, by the way, Nazi Germany did not let Jews even leave the country. So unique identifier, in my mind, I do equate to that big red J on the passport. And the curious thing about this is what the law says. The law says that if you were convicted of a sex offense involving a minor and you're currently required to register, the State Department must add a unique identifier. Gotta get some water, excuse me. The State Department must add a unique identifier to your passport. But this is the deal. They're not doing it. So their burden really is upon the State Department to, in fact, identify you as a person who has to have a unique identifier added to their new passport. Okay. So what happens, but what has happened is that the State Department has tried to shift that burden, has in fact shifted the burden from the State Department to the individual, where they're now telling you that you have to request that a unique identifier be added to your passport. And I don't know about you all, but I think that's absolutely terrible, but that's what the law says. So here's one of those situations where you can decide whether or not you want to take the risk. Okay. If you have an existing passport and it hasn't expired, do you want to get a new passport? And again, you're somebody who was convicted of an offense involving a minor, plus you're currently required to register in any state, even Florida, which you might have visited 20 years ago, but you're still on the registry. So if you don't have a unique identifier on your passport and you're one of those covered sex offenders, then the danger, the risk that you're running is in fact that they can, in fact, they being the State Department, can revoke your passport at any point in time. And it has happened. So I talk about this a lot, and I'm letting you know this is an outlier, but this has happened to a registrant living in California who basically purchased a ticket to go to Europe to one of the Schengen nations that normally allow registrants to come visit. And he was, you know, he and his wife had checked their bags. They'd gotten on the board of the flight. They were sitting in their seats waiting for the plane to take off when he was tapped on the shoulder by a DHS official who basically told him that he had to get off the plane because he didn't have a passport. And he said, well, of course I do. And he pulled his passport out. Well, guess what? The DHS officer took his passport right then and there and said, your passport is revoked. So guess what? They had to get off the plane. They didn't take their European trip, and it cost them a lot of money and grief. So Dave, you have your hand up. Dave, please go ahead. Dave, it looks like you need to unmute yourself.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay. So I was wondering if we end up going to another country and then like let's say go to Europe and then sign out of the California registry, so now I'm not on the registry, and then I'm in Europe and I apply for a new passport in Europe, will I get one without an identifier since I'm not on the registry anymore?
Why would you do that in Europe? Why wouldn't you do it in the United States?
Because if I apply for one, I'd be on the registry and I'd get one with an identifier. But if I go to another country and apply for another passport from there, I'm thinking I could get one without the identifier, and I can go to the other country I want to go to from there without having any identifier in my passport.
Are you talking about moving to another country?
Yeah, yeah. But I'm thinking about going somewhere in between, like Europe, and then applying for a new passport while I'm there, so I could end up going to my desired country without the identifier inside. Would that be a strategy that would work? And would I have to give another notice from traveling after I give notice that I'm traveling out of the country? Do I have to give any other notices if I do any subsequent travel after that?
Well, I'm confused by whether or not you're talking about you're visiting other countries or are you moving to another country.
I want to move, but the thing is, I'm going to visit one country and then move to another.
Well, my understanding is so if you're not required to register in any state, then they can't put the unique identifier on your passport.
Okay.
So, but you have to get off the, it depends on the state. Okay. Believe it or not. Yeah, so Dave, like California, if you leave the state of California and you tell California, I'm moving overseas, they take you off the registry, the California registry. You're completely off. The question is whether or not you're on the registry of any other state. So some people like who visited New York or visited Florida, and there's a couple more states, they never take you off the registry.
Wow. I didn't know New York did that too. That's horrible.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe it makes sense for you to call me during this coming week and we can talk about your specific situation, because unfortunately, there's not a clear answer.
Okay. I have tried to call you, but I just can't get through. What's the best way to do it? Should I just send an email or?
Well, they can start with an email, sure, and request a meeting. Sure. I mean, if anybody calls me and I don't answer the phone, you leave a voicemail message and normally I will answer. I will say, though, I don't have a secretary or administrative assistant, so I'm not always 100% good at returning phone calls just because I've written it down on a piece of paper and lost a piece of paper. So if I don't, the bottom line is, folks, if you try to reach me and you don't reach me the first time, call me again. Okay, eventually you will get to me. And if you set up a meeting, a phone meeting with me, that's even better, because then I won't be on the phone with somebody else or I won't be in court.
Thank you so much. I have just one more quick question. It's slightly off topic. If you want to answer it, you can. I want to know if you heard of people getting asylum because of these type of things. Like, I heard there was a guy, he went to Germany and applied for asylum because of these identifiers.
I don't know about that, no.
Thank you very much.
Sure. You might want to go on our website. I know and Roger, maybe you can speak up here. There's a part of our website where there's people that are conversing about international all the time. I know of people who have left the country, people who were on the registry, and they just, for one reason or another, decided to leave the country permanently. And so I know that it has been done. I don't know about that specific program that you mentioned, Dave.
Thank you so much. Thank you kindly.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking. Okay. So Roger put in the chat room there where you can go to get the information about international travel. And folks, I do encourage people on the registry to go to Europe. There are 29 nations in Europe right now, and they're called the Schengen nations, and we do have the list. So if you go to where Roger in this link that Roger put here on the website, then you'll know it have the list of 29 countries. The four large countries are Italy, France, Germany, and Spain. That's four. And there's 25 smaller countries. Okay. And you can go to those countries and they don't even care if you have a unique identifier on your passport. So I'm sure they think that there's something wrong with our country, that we do this to our citizens. And I have to agree with them. There is something wrong, but it can be done. So enjoy. And I know, Roger, you just went to Europe and do you want to discuss briefly your experience traveling overseas?
Yeah, essentially, it wasn't a problem. Nobody ever mentioned that during any part of the trip, except when I got back to the U.S., they said, well, you're flagged. We need to check your luggage. 18 years ago, when I went to Europe, they spent 3 or 4 hours downloading photographs from my phone and so on. This time I was staying with my brother and I went on a guided tour and I told him that. And the guy said, well, do you have anything to declare, you know, like alcohol and things like that? I said, no. And he said, okay, you're good. And I was able to go. I think part of the issue was I was with my brother and an established tour. So if you look at the other extreme, if I went to, say, Thailand on my own or something like that, I think that would be much more suspicious, right, that something's going on. So I think your situation can alter how they treat you when you're coming home again. While I was there, there was nothing. Now, you can take precautions when you travel. is don't bring a computer. I did bring a computer because I had to work for you guys, and upload all your photos, you know, online before you come back, and then erase your phone's memory and your what's on your computer. But in general, I did not feel hassled at all or any problem like that. I would say take the risk, you know, do the travel to the Xinjiang Nations. It's one of the few places on the planet you can still get around to. And especially now, they have a new system called ETIAS that's coming out, European Travel Information Authorization System. The Xinjiang Nations are sort of like our states, where you don't have to show ID to get from state to state. And it's the same thing. When we were traveling around, I didn't have to show my passport in multiple countries. However, apparently people have abused that system. And so they're doing what I call Visa Lite, which is the ETIAS system that won't be activated for probably another year, year and a half. You'll have to apply online to each of the countries you're going to. It's not as odious as a full visa, but it is another hassle. So if you're going to go on a tour with multiple countries, you have to make sure that you apply to each one, because what happens if one of the countries doesn't want you? And, you know, what do you do with your tour, right? So just use caution. Keep looking at our website on the international travel link that I sent you. We'll keep you up to date as we can on the ETIAS system. But please don't be afraid. You know, we use reasonable precautions, like I took. I got a new passport a year ahead, because if you have a passport that's less than a year, the country probably won't let you in. So a year ahead, make sure you have a passport that's valid. I set my reminder on my calendar to every 9 years to renew it. And remember to ask, you have to have a letter that asks to have a unique identifier put on your passport if you qualify, like me. And I know that seems humiliating, but it's just one of the things we have to do. And I think I'll put that sample letter on that page too, but it's pretty simple. You just say, please add a unique identifier to my passport. That's about all you're doing. And then make sure that you get in that 21 day well ahead of time. I had some problems with getting the passport, and you can't, if you try to go tell the police, okay, I'm leaving in 21 days or less, and you don't have your passport, well, the passport number is on the form. So they'll say, well, bring, come back when you have a passport. So that was a problem for me. I just barely made the deadline. So be sure you do those way ahead of time. Get that out. If you can go on a tour, that will establish that you're with other people, might risk the problems of when you come back to the U.S. So anyway, those are just some of the tips.
All right. Thank you, Roger, for that. And a question somebody asked here in chat was, did you have a unique identifier on your passport? I think you just said you did. Is that correct?
Yes, it's two very small lines of text, and it's beneath a second photo of me, a black and white photo on the facing page. So it's very small print. And again, I think the only place they asked for my passport, believe it or not, was in tours of churches where you get an audio tour. And they said, well, we want to make sure you bring our equipment back, so give us your ID. Okay, whatever. None of the churches actually looked at in the inside. So I would not have the fear that people are going to stop you on the streets. Hey, I need to see your passport. Are you a sex offender? That's not going to happen.
Yeah. Thank you, Roger, for that insight. And Roger just recently came back from being overseas, folks. He did go to Europe. And again, Europe is in those 29 countries are in fact open to people on the registry, even if you have a unique identifier. The United Kingdom, by the way, is not open to people on the registry. And I actually just got a report from somebody who had already been removed from the registry here in California, and he tried to get into Mexico. He was doing it on a cruise ship, and Mexico would not let him disembark the ship. So that's the first report that I've gotten from somebody who's no longer required to register about that. He did not, in fact, give anybody a 21-day notice because he's not required to, and yet Mexico disallowed him. Now, I think maybe the paperwork, I don't know, he wasn't my client. I don't know what period of time there was between the time his requirement to register was terminated and this trip happened. You know, in an abundance of caution, folks, I'd say wait at least 3 months, if not 6 months, before you travel after you your registration requirement has been terminated, because the governments are governments, right? And it's going to take them a while to get the paperwork right. But you might also want to take a copy of your paperwork with you if you're going to travel overseas. Did you do that, Rob? Roger? Did you, I mean, you're still on the registry, but did you take any paperwork with you?
Yes. And I included a copy of the application for the 21-day notice. Everything I could think of, I just stuffed in my suitcase just in case. I didn't need it, but definitely good to have.
Okay, thank you. And I know Roger said something too about Thailand. Folks, the whole continent of Asia is closed to people on the registry. You're not going to be able to directly travel to Asia. You will be rejected. You won't get out of the airport. I mean, it's not like, well, you won't get to see your favorite sites. You won't even be able to see if somebody's there to welcome you to that country. You won't even see them. They will not let you out of the airport. And most of the time, they don't let you make phone calls either or send you text messages. You're just, you know, in no man's land. So, yeah. So please don't do it. Don't try to go to Asia directly. Because if you do, you will be stopped. And by the way, the same can be said of Mexico and Canada as well. Canada, I feel a little bit better about because in Canada, they don't allow anybody who's been convicted of a felony to come visit. It's not just people on the registry. And then Mexico, I don't know. This is not legal advice, but I've heard stories from people who have successfully walked across the border, taken a taxi across the border, you know, gotten into Mexico that way. But if you don't give advance notice, then you know, there's a possibility you're violating the international Megan's Law. Remember, folks, it's about a matter of risk. How much risk are you willing to take? So I'm going to ask, does anybody have any questions now about international or domestic travel? Okay, someone here, Marina, has said, when we travel internationally, I email each consulate for permission, only the Schengen countries. I take copies of those email replies. You know what? That's really a good thing to do. So no one has ever asked, but we take it with us. When we return from international, I carry my husband's phone and backpack. That's an even better idea. All right. So, you know, they're not going to search the possessions of the spouse or the person you're traveling with, only the person who's traveling. So if you are traveling with another person, maybe to expedite the system, and I'm not saying violate the law, but to expedite the system, you could, in fact, travel with a friend and then that friend can carry electronics with them. And because, as Roger just said, it used to take him hours in going through secondary. And sometimes I know people even missed planes and trains that way. Okay, so I don't see any questions about travel, so let's move on. SORNA litigation, I mentioned it briefly earlier, but it bears repeating and expanding upon. So there is a lawsuit that's pending. The litigators are the Pacific Legal Foundation, and Axol is one of the plaintiffs. Both Jeff and I have former clients who are also plaintiffs in the lawsuit. And it's all about whether or not these SORNA regulations basically violate that separation of powers. So supposedly, the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch have equal power. I think that's being tested right now. I don't even think. I know it's being tested right now. Where are the boundaries for those different branches of government? Well, this lawsuit has to do, again, with regulations that were passed by the federal government that they say apply to everybody, even if you're not in a SORNA-compliant state. So we think that they went too far, to put it mildly. And this litigation has been pending for quite some time. There was a hearing that was scheduled actually for next Monday, July 14th, but the hearing date has been changed. So this judge appears to change hearing dates easily and often, easily for him, but not for the rest of us, I'd say. But anyway, the new hearing date now is 3 weeks later. So the new hearing date is August 4th. You should have gotten an email or text message about this with the new hearing date, August 4th, as well as a link to how you can, in fact, watch the hearing remotely. So you don't have to travel to the deserts in California to do this. You can, in fact, watch it from the comfort of your home and your computer, and it could be interesting oral argument once it happens. It's also possible, folks, that there will not be any oral argument in the case. Maybe the judge is close to issuing a decision but wants to wait a few more weeks so that he, too, can reference that case that we talked about earlier, the Trump versus Casa case and injunctive relief, because if you remember, the judge in this case has issued a preliminary injunction. Unfortunately, it only is helping people in the state of California. I've just been so hopeful that he, in fact, would expand the preliminary injunction to the entire nation. I don't think he's going to do that now because of this recent Supreme Court decision, again, Trump versus Casa, but we shall see. He seems to have, he's brave. He seems to be willing to stick his neck out. We'll see how far he's willing to stick his neck out. So
I just wanted to add one thought.
Sure.
In the past, Judge Bernal has extended the dates with some significant amount of time. This one only changed to August 4th from July 14th, so not very far. And at least my intuition was that he might be getting ready to take the step that has been anticipated but deferred. Had he intended to do something substantial, the break would have been 6 weeks, 2 months, something longer than 3 weeks. So keep my fingers crossed.
We're going to write that down, Jeff. We have a deficit on this date. No, I hope you're right. I do. He's been a favorable judge all along, and he's really held the government to account, and I've been encouraged by that. And I've been encouraged that he was willing to issue a preliminary injunction, even if he did limit it to registrants in California. So, Mark, you have your hand up. Mark in transit.
In the CASA case, which I think is the baby case, it seems like they were able to do a class action across the U.S. Is that something realistic in the SORNA case? And I'll pass.
I'm not quite sure what you mean, Mark.
Meaning, it's trying to establish turning into a class action. It seems like rather quickly in that case, they've already gotten it to be a class action with injunction and countrywide. Is that even realistic in the SORNA cases to do a class action? I'm not asking right, I'll let it go anyway.
Well, I mean, the SORNA case is already filed. I don't know at this late date if it could be amended, if that's what you're asking, to turn it into a class action lawsuit. It's not a class action lawsuit right now. I don't remember how many plaintiffs we have, 5 or 6. It's not everybody who's on the registry in the United States, because everybody could possibly be a plaintiff, or at least most people.
I guess I will. Yeah. My understanding of the Supreme Court decision was it had to be a class action in order to be considered across the board to take effect everywhere.
Yeah, I don't think the Supreme Court said it had to be a class action. I think they suggested the possibility of it being a class action. And so that possibility was acted on in a number of places around the country, but they're all very young and too young to have any kind of definitive ruling. So maybe it's just those are litigation decisions that Pacific Legal Foundation, whose lead counsel, will be making. And I don't think we've had those discussions yet. We haven't had any opposed briefings to suggest it yet either.
No, we haven't. We're just going to have to wait and see. I mean, I would think at this point in time, it's less likely than it was before that Judge Bernal will issue a nationwide injunction. And I hope I'm wrong. And the other thing is, no matter how the judge rules in this case, folks, his decision is going to be appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. I mean, we know that. Okay, he knows that. That's one reason I think he's taking so much time and being so careful in his decision, is he knows that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is going to review his decision. So whoever loses this round is going to appeal. We already know that. Okay. Then the question is, possibly, could it even go all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court? I mean, these days, I think that's just too much speculation at any time, certainly at this point in time, because we're just at the trial court level. So stay tuned. It is exciting. And again, hearing is scheduled for August 4. All right. So let's talk about the Missouri case briefly. That case is on appeal. Again, the trial court judge in that case issued a permanent statewide injunction, which is fabulous because it means that the state of Missouri cannot, in fact, enforce a state law that required every single person on the registry to post a sign on their home on Halloween. So the trial court judge said this is a violation of the First Amendment. It's compelled speech. And it's a fabulous, fabulous decision. Attorney General appealed it very quickly. And I'm not surprised. And it is, you know, so we're up on appeal already. This has been up on appeal for many months. And we still don't have a date for oral argument. I don't know if the Eighth Circuit was watching what was going on in the U.S. Supreme Court or not about injunctions. But I have to say, I actually feel comfortable with this injunction for the following reason. This injunction was basically issued after a full trial. Okay. This was not, so some of these other requests for injunctive relief, you do it early in the case when there hasn't been a trial, but we've already been to trial. We've already presented the evidence. We've already had witnesses testify. We've done all of these things in the Missouri case. So I'm optimistic that even on appeal, the Eighth Circuit would uphold this, preliminary injunction, or I'm sorry, permanent injunction. So we shall see. You can write that down on your calendar too. Janice said today that She's optimistic that the Eighth Circuit will, in fact, allow the this permanent injunction to continue. But we shall see what, in fact, happens. And again, there's no hearing date yet for oral argument. The Eighth Circuit does not hear oral argument in this during the summer. So we're talking about September at the earliest. Between you and me, I hope that the Eighth Circuit doesn't hear this case until November, until after Halloween. Wouldn't that be sweet? And I say that because we do have an injunction in place, and therefore the state of Missouri cannot enforce their Halloween sign, so state law. So stay tuned for that. Hopefully no tricks, just treats. All right. Moving on to a positive decision that came from all places, the 11th Circuit. And it was talking about a law in the state of Alabama, and it had to do with family rights. And it basically saluted the family as being something so wholesome and part of the fabric of America that, of course, even somebody on the registry has family rights. And so this, in fact, told the 11th Circuit, told or ruled that, in fact, this registrant could, in fact, live with his child. I think it was his son. Don't hold me to that. But anyway, it's an encouraging decision because, as I said, of all places, it came from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. They review cases in Alabama and many southern states, and they're not usually, they don't usually rule in favor of registrants. So this is a notable decision. It was issued about 2 months ago now. And I'm bringing it up, I did, even though I talked about it briefly last month, because I know we have some new listeners today. In fact, why don't I just go ahead and ask, folks, one way or the other, can you raise your hand if you're not, if you live outside of the state of California? That would be nice to know. How many people who are on right now do not live in California? Not too many. Okay. Well, we welcome everybody. We do. And so we're glad that you're here. I'm just kind of curious. Okay. All right. So so then we're going to go on to some issues that really are California-centric issues. The first one is a brand new lawsuit that's about to be filed. And so you're hearing it first. Well, the board might have heard about it already, but other than the board of directors, we haven't posted an article about it yet because the lawsuit has not been filed. So the lawsuit has to do with females on the registry. And that's such an interesting issue because there aren't that many. And we got a number from the government through a Public Records Act request recently. They said there's 126 women who are currently on the California registry and who are considered high risk. And the reason that's important is the Department of Corrections is using a tool to determine the risk of reoffense of women. Actually, the tool they're using has not been validated by anybody. And that's important because that's the law says it has to be validated by somebody, and this has been validated by no one. So instead, what's happened is that the Department of Corrections here in California came up with their own, dare I say, Ouija board as far as deciding whether or not a woman on the registry is going to, is at risk of reoffense. And the problem is, too, that they're saying that only if you are low risk. Okay, what they're doing is they're casting a net too wide. So they're saying that women on the registry who will score either as moderate or high risk on this unvalidated tool that they're using are indeed, quote, high risk. And this has really significant repercussions upon the women then. And many of them are homeless because of this, because there's a state law that says if you're on the registry and on parole and high risk, all three factors, registry, parole, high risk, then you cannot live within half mile of a school, okay? Any school. So it can be private, it can be public, it can be K through 6, it can be, you know, 9 through 12, but it's really a burden, and it's really hard for anybody to find housing if they're considered high risk and the state law applies to them. So the lawsuit is about this group of people and trying to, and challenging CDCR's use of this, it's called the FSORA, F-S-O-R-A, and think of it this way, if you would. The Static 99, developed by Dr. Carl Hansen and then improved upon since that point in time. Dr. Carl Hansen and his folks, I mean, they developed a Static 99 decades ago, and they've improved upon it. And so there's been like tens of thousands, if not even more, people who have been assessed using this tool. And so it's been validated. They know that if whatever the risk assignment here is, according to them, is is significant is validated. It's a validated tool, whether or not it's true. Okay, but it's a validated tool. By comparison, under FSORA, the FSORA is not validated, and so it's really people and their hunches, and folks, that's just not good enough for me. So we're about to file the lawsuit. We have an expert in this case, a PhD psychologist or social worker rather, from Canada. And Dr. Franca Cortoni is her name. And Dr. Cortoni is an expert when it comes to females on the registry. And she's got a lot of fabulous data that we're using in the lawsuit. Because part of this is that the number of registrants female registrants is so low. And then the rate at which they reoffend is so low that's one reason that there's no tool that can be validated. Just they say it's not even possible. So anyway, no woman on the registry should in fact be prohibited from living within half a mile of a school. And when it comes to people on the registry, and by the way, men are also affected by this law. Again, if they're considered high risk, you can't live within half a mile of a school. And by the way, this is only when you're on parole. So after you get off of parole, you can live anywhere you want. But the fact is that we're talking about people on parole and where they can live. Okay. Does anybody have a question or comment about that before we move on? Question. Are many of these women registrants former teachers? Yes, they are, actually. I think I would say, just a wild guess here, I'd say at least half of them are. The women who are teachers are, a teacher is an authority figure and held to a higher standard. I think sometimes women who are not teachers basically are not held to the same account because they're not authority figures. Okay, so let's move on then. This is a continuing saga here in California. It's talking about registrants who are on parole. And we have over 7,000 people in California who are both on the registry and on parole. And we caught the Department of Corrections breaking the law. That's always an interesting thought. You think about it. The Department of Corrections was breaking the law? Yes, they were. Okay. And so with the Department of Corrections, they were basically requiring every registrant while on parole to undergo treatment. And that doesn't make sense. And the reason that it's against the law, it was violating the state law, is the state law said a minimum of 1 year of treatment. And after that, continued treatment was to be made on a case-by-case basis. And by the way, the third component of that law is a Superior Court judge can end treatment at any time. So in order to settle the case that was filed by me, by the way, the Department of Corrections said, okay, tell you what, we will issue regulations. Here are the regulations. We're going to issue these regulations, which are a vast improvement. And it basically said, okay, if in fact a decision is made by CDCR that a person requires additional treatment, then we're going to put that decision in writing. Wow. And it's going to, in fact, include the reason why somebody needs more treatment. Fabulous. But the best part about it is that the person, the registrant, was supposed to get a copy of that document. And within 30 days, you know what? I think I've only heard from 3 people who have actually gotten their document. The rest of the time, CDCR is playing hide the ball, and they're not providing that information. They're just telling the person, yeah, you have to continue in treatment. So we are working on a lawsuit in this regard as well. It's not as well developed as the one about the female registrants, principally because the registrants have to go through a 602 process. We're expecting their 602s to be denied, and then when the 602s are denied, then we can file a lawsuit because we would have exhausted of the administrative remedies. So stay tuned for that one. I would imagine we'll get that one done this summer, if not July, by August. It kind of depends how quickly CDCR denies the 602 forms that they file. Does anybody have any questions about this before we move on? Okay, I have 602 in the CTM process. Good. Paul, you have your hand up. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I was just curious because my commitment offense was failing to notify the authorities when leaving the state of California, which I received a 25 to life. And I'm in treatment now on parole, and I've gotten mixed information regarding it. So I would be interested in any type of information you had on that.
Okay, well, I think that's such a narrow issue that I'm not going to discuss it during today's meeting. But if you would contact me during the week, that would be great. Roger, if you'd be so kind to put my contact information in the chat, that would be wonderful. I don't have a keyboard right now. Okay. Thank you. Okay. All right. So let's move on then to the tiered registry law. So the tiered registry law was passed way back in 2017. It seems ancient history almost, right? 2017? We're talking about 8 years ago. But the fact is it didn't go into effect until 2021, all right? And that's when people could start filing petitions. So under the tiered registry law, nobody gets off the registry automatically. If you are eligible, you can petition for removal in the county where you currently reside. So Jeff and I and LD2, all three of us have helped people get off the registry under the tiered registry law. It's a lot better than the prior process, the certificate of rehabilitation, because quite frankly, more people are eligible under the tiered registry law. Having said that, it's not a perfect law. We know that. So we've been working very hard for very many years, ever since the tiered registry law got passed, to improve the tiered registry law, right? And so by improving it, what we mean is making more people eligible to petition for removal. I will say at this point in time, more than 8,000 people have been removed from the California registry, more than 8,000 of their petitions have been granted. And that's a decent number, but it's not nearly as many people as we think are eligible. So we're saving that for another day, that conversation. But if you think you might be eligible, please let us know. If you're wondering if you're eligible, please let us know. Dave, you have your hand up. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I wanted to know the issue with the timing, and then the fact that if you lived out of the country during that time, does that take away from...
Yes. Okay. I think Dave is finished. Dave, are you
sorry.
Finished?
Yeah, that's what, sorry. That's basically what I was asking. If time out of the country takes away from the registry, or if there's any remedy for that based on longstanding of not having any problems.
Unfortunately, if you move out of the country, that time does not count. So, and what Dave is talking about is under the tiered registry law, if you're assigned to tier one, you have to have registered for 10 years, a minimum of 10 years. If you're assigned to tier two, it's a minimum of 20 years. And I had a case, it hasn't gone up on appeal. I don't want to take it up on appeal. My client might've taken his case to another attorney, and it may be going on appeal. But anyway, the bottom line is he spent 10 of his 20 years living in Mexico, being a law abiding citizen there, establishing a successful business, et cetera. And then he moved back to California. So he had more than 20 years, if you counted the time in Mexico, but the trial court judge said, no, we're not going to count that time. And you know what? Is that a reasonable interpretation law? Maybe. We were testing the waters there, and we got the answer, quite frankly, that I thought we would get, which is it does not. But other than that, if you've been in this United States and you've registered somewhere in the United States, the time for registration starts with the day after you're released from custody, okay, whether you go to jail or prison. It's the day after you get out of custody, and then it goes forward. Now, there's some other things that can interfere with that that might make the period of time longer than 10 years or longer than 20 years. Things like if you fail to register and you had a misdemeanor sex offense, it's going to add 1 year. If it's a felony, then it's 3 years for every time you fail to register. There's other things to look at. Do you have any pending criminal charges, et cetera? So there's some things, again, that could affect the basic number of years. But the going in, the place where you start is if you're assigned to tier one, it takes 10 years. If you're assigned to tier two, it takes 20 years. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
And you're certainly welcome.
And one more thing. What if someone just comes in and just for their birthday and registers and leaves? Would that count? Or I don't understand. I don't know how they would do it.
Well, I think that the problem you would have if you lived outside the country, which I think is your question, that you don't really reside there, right? And so, I mean, the place where you register is supposed to be the place where you reside. Now, you can have something called concurrent registration, which means that you could be required to register in more than one place. If it's something like that, then maybe. but yeah, I don't feel comfortable giving a concrete answer on a recorded line here.
Fair enough. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Jeff and Ellie, you've both done other tiered cases, petition cases. Would you like to speak to the tiered registry law?
Sure. Ellie, you want to go first?
No, you go ahead. You're probably
all right.
I have.
So my starting point is that it's astounding that there are as many people who are eligible who are afraid to file petition as there are. And, you know, this is an experience that has been traumatizing people from their original court exposure. But the reality is that there is no punitive downside that's creating a vulnerability for anybody who petitions and is denied termination. What happens happens in that context is you're delayed in being able to reapply, but it's not a criminal exposure. There's no punishment that's potential. The punishment is continuing on the registry. So the overwhelming encouragement would be to recognize that the process of seeking termination is a one-way positive opportunity that anybody who's eligible owes to themselves to take advantage of. And if you do, the potential is that you get removed. So I had two people removed this week who got letters from DOJ who were reluctant, but kind of bucked up and decided to dive into the process and succeeded. And, you know, the post-removal communications kind of touched on how life-changing this removal process is. Having done certificates of rehabilitation and struggled with trial judges who wanted to deny them because of philosophical reasons, this law was written in a way that vastly favors removal as opposed to the prior law, which was very fundamentally discouraging of removal, at least in a way it was produced and drafted. So if you are nearing the 10-year or 20-year threshold, you should consider taking action. The second categorical thing that is still viable and still available that people should consider is people who are convicted of 311.11, this is possession of CP offenses, or sexual battery 243.4. Both of those as felonies are tier three lifetime. It has been an open question since a case decision in 2023 as to how people who get reductions from felony to misdemeanor, these are people who got probation, not prison, how they would be treated by DOJ. And I can report, having now handled several of these, that DOJ is re-tiering people who get reductions in that context from tier three to tier one. And I have at least three clients who have gone through that process, been successful in motions to reduce in the trial court, and been recategorized from tier three to tier one and eligible for termination after 10 years. So if you are in that category, it's a multi-step process, and it's one that kind of dovetails with what your ultimate options are for termination petitions. There's a variety of ways in which these can be pursued. They can be pursued as a bare bones. They can be pursued in a very energetic and high level thing. It's more time and it requires more resources to do the energetic. It creates a lower risk that you're going to be denied either at the reduction of felony stage or at the termination stage. And I think it's, you know, it's the unfortunate reality that everything takes time and costs money, but it's worth it for the outcome enhancement that comes along. So if you're in that felony reducible probation granted environment, I just think it's a important thing to explore. And, you know, to be able to prepare the petition, to do the kind of supplemental materials that persuades DAs and judges and creates a record that's sustainable, it takes time. So I wouldn't wait till the day before your eligibility would show up. Start 8 months or a year ahead of time and do that preparation that you can do that requires finding friends or people who have known you over time, or if available, forensic psychologists to do risk assessments to make these applications as persuasive and as powerful as you can, and it increases the likelihood of success and the significance.
Thank you, Jeff. Ellie, you want to add to that?
Yes. Somebody just put in the chat if you can get a felony reduced to a misdemeanor. If the crime is considered a wobbler, meaning that it wobbles between a felony and misdemeanor, and if it is charged as a felony and there's a state prison sentence, it will remain a felony. But if the individual got a probationary sentence and it is a wobbler and it was initially filed as a felony, there possibly there is a motion and a statute in California that would allow the reduction of a felony to a misdemeanor. However, sometimes judges will deny the reduction of these eligible offenses because they realize that there would be a tier change. And as Janice mentioned, not all felonies are wobblers. There's just a handful. But sometimes judges do not want to reduce a felony to a misdemeanor because they know exactly that the tier will change and the registration requirement could be terminated. I hope I answered that question. What Jeff said is really important, and I think we need to get the word out that people who are eligible to have their registration terminated need to apply. And one thing I wanted to add, because Jeff said it so well, it doesn't have to be 10 consecutive years. I had a client who picked up his offense that required registration, and he had a few more cases that sent him to prison, but he had the requisite 10 years, even though it was in bits and pieces. So it doesn't have to be 10 consecutive years.
Yeah. Thank you, Ellie, for that clarification. And I know, Ellie, you and I have discussed this in the past. I'm not sure, Jeff, we probably discussed it as well. The question is, and maybe this is the reason some people are hesitant to petition for removal, because they have other criminal offenses on the record, right? And so I've had tested it once before, and this was somebody who was convicted of a white collar crime. It was basically something like a Ponzi scheme. And the judge had no problem granting his petition. So that was good to know. And now I've got a case in court next week, and this gentleman has quite a lengthy rap sheet, but he's only got one sex offense on it, and he's more than eligible. He's on tier two. He's more than eligible to petition for removal. And the DA's office just a few days ago let me know that they're not going to object to his petition. So that means the court's going to grant it. So this is maybe, folks, you know, you can pass this information on to others of your friends or your people in group or whatever that might be reluctant to petition for removal, and just say, you know what, the courts are granting most of these petitions. I can just tell you from my experience that I have 131 petitions that I have filed have been granted. Only one of them has been denied, and that one was because he spent 10 years outside the state, outside the United States, and he wasn't registered anywhere. But it wasn't that he was avoiding or evading registration. It was just the, you know, country of Mexico doesn't register people. And they may be smarter than we are, perhaps. So anyway, but when it comes even to objections from a district attorney, less than 10% of my petitions have been objected to by a district attorney. And because of that, I take a different approach than Jeff, and that I don't have a lot of paperwork done ahead of time. I wait to see if the DA is going to object to the petition. And then if the DA objects to the petition, that means there's going to be a hearing. And to me, that's the time when you get a psychological assessment. That's when you get letters of support, etc. And I'm not criticizing Jeff at all for what he does. He's very thorough and he's got a great track record. But you know, we're different attorneys. We do things different ways. But again, if you're talking to somebody and they might think, oh my gosh, it doesn't take 12 months. I'd say when people contact me, I say just count on 6 months. I'm going to tell you it's going to take 6 months, and chances are it's going to take less than 6 months. It depends on the county a lot as well. But the fact is then, you know, then you'll be happily surprised. So I don't know, Ellie, do you want to add anything at this point in time, or Jeff?
No.
Okay. I would just say I think there are both approaches, both the expedited and the more in-depth versions can be done and can be tailored to your individual needs. There's no requirement that anybody do it any particular way. It's just a matter of offering the options. And yeah. I think both can be successful depending on what fits.
Yeah. And one of the, I'm testing the waters in another case of one of my cases, in that this poor man has tried over and over again to get a form from the registration office. The form is called proof of current registration. The form number is 8050. He's tried so many times to get his 8050, and they just won't give it to him. Now he has instead the tier assignment letter from the Department of Justice. So we're going to go ahead and file his petition without the 8050. And I really did not want to do that. And I've warned him that the court might dismiss the case because the 8050 is not attached. But one of the reasons that I think it's worth doing is an attorney from the Department of Justice who comes to the case on meetings, the Sex Offender Management Board, he said that the 8050 is not required. So, which is interesting concept, because it was the Department of Justice that created the form 8050, right? But and you know what, he doesn't work for the court. So what is an 8050? It's called the proof of current registration. It's a 2-page form. You get it from the office where you register, okay? And it's only 2 pages. It is not the same as your annual registration form, and you'll know that because the annual registration form is 6 pages long. So proof of current registration is a a two-page form, and on the front page of that form, it basically lists what your tier assignment is right there. Okay, so maybe that's why the courts like it. I don't know. Again, we'll see if this letter from DOJ telling somebody what their tier assignment, if that's good enough, if it's going to work in that one case. But I think, I'm sure that Ellie, Jeff, and I all are encouraging people to go ahead and file a petition. You know, consult with an attorney. Many, if not most counties, the public defender's offices will in fact file a petition on your behalf. And one of the other things that's happened, and I know one person in the chat has been talking about trying to get a tier assignment. So according to the according to the tiered registry law, DOJ has up to 24 months to assign somebody a tier when they move into the state. And this is particularly vexing because you cannot petition without a tier assignment, because then you don't know what tier you're supposed to be assigned to. The other thing is, if in fact you were convicted in California, you moved out of state and you registered in another state, and then you come back to California, those tier assignments seem to happen much more quickly. But if you're really having a problem, and I know this one woman is with her husband, contact me, Jeff, or Ellie and stuff, and we'll see what we can do. We did file a lawsuit against the California Department of Justice a couple of years ago, and that lawsuit had to do with their failure to assign people to tiers. It was particularly onerous. It was particularly vexing. I don't know. I was really pissed off with the fact that it was taking California DOJ so long to assign people's tiers. And according to the tiered registry law, people's tiers were supposed to be assigned by a certain date. There was actually a deadline. They didn't meet their deadline, despite the fact that the legislature gave them 4 years before the law went into effect, and they got 60 new full-time employees. So to me, they got more than adequate resources to do this, and they still failed to do it on time. And that's why we sued them. Lo and behold, after we sued them, the rate of reassignment or tier assignments increased significantly. It used to be over 12,500, and I believe we're only down to a couple of hundred right now. So that's better than it was, but it's still not perfect. Mark, you have your hand up.
Hang on. Oh, there, I got it. When mine went past my birthday, I did get kind of panicky with my attorney, and sure enough, it just took time, and the person who sent a form forgot to sign it. And da, 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 da. Also, I want to say after being off, that following up, searching for yourself, and then following up with Yahoo, Google, etc. There's a way in there. Tell them to take you off. That's not true information. Most of them take it off quick. Yahoo waits 2 weeks, etc. Thank you.
You're welcome. That's good information, Mark. Thank you for sharing that with others. Yeah. So, and I think one of the points that he made that's worth repeating is, in fact, that there are private websites out there that list people who are required to register. Many of them, if not most, if not all, rather, will, in fact, remove you from their website if, in fact, you give them a copy of the court order that basically says you're no longer required to register. Okay. So there's, we've covered a lot of ground in this meeting. I'm about to call the meeting to adjourn the meeting, Ellie. She's our president, so she adjourns the meetings. But before we do that, I want to remind people that we do have a challenge grant right now. We have a very generous individual who basically gave us $10,000 and said, okay, here it is. If you can match it, then you can keep all $10,000. So please, 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 if you can, if you're able to make a donation of $5 or any other amount, please make that donation. It's easy to do on the AXAW website, or you can mail us a check, do it old-fashioned way. I'll put the mailing address here in the chat room. So that's how I want to end the meeting with my comments. We will be back on the right, the correct Saturday next month, so the third Saturday in August. I wish I would have written it down, but I'm going to look right now. We'll be back on the third Saturday in August, which happens to be August 16th. So I'll look forward to seeing you guys there. Ellie or Jeff, any closing comments?
I appreciate everybody being on board. Someone just asked, what's an 8050? So that's a California Department of Justice form. The initials are CJIS 8050, and it's proof of current registration. It's a two-page form, not the six-page form with all the initials that you normally do.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. And Ellie?
The only thing I want to say is this is the second Saturday of the month, and normally we have the third Saturday of the month for these meetings. This was an exception. So I'm assuming next month for August. It'll be the third Saturday of the month. So stay tuned.
Yes, it will be the third Saturday, and that date is August 16th. Look forward to seeing you all then. Thank you so much. God bless. Bye-bye. Bye.